You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. For instance, today's episode was produced in part by Clifton, Leticia, Ron, Carl, Tim, Lisa, Susanna, Homestead Brooklyn, Brody, Kevin, Sophia, Plant by Design, Mark, Katharina, Sammy and Sven, Renz, Bendix, Aaron A., Holly, Mountain Misery Farms, Caitlin, Rosanna, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, and Margie. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants, and together we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host Matt, and welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? Today is yet another fascinating interview, and one that is way out of my wheelhouse in terms of understanding. Joining us is University of Florida professor Robert Furl, and Dr. Furl's work is all about growing plants in space. Let me say that again. In space. Now, he does this in some pretty unique ways. He himself has never been in space, but Dr. Furl has had a hand in decades worth of plants in space research, and the way they go about studying it and the way they go about understanding how to grow plants is remarkable. In fact, one of my favorite stories and how I came to know Dr. Furl's work is how he figured out why wheat seeds were not growing into plants that then produced seeds themselves. And the workaround there and what ended up actually explaining this phenomenon was quite remarkable. Now, keep in mind, there's a lot of talk about going into space, and if humans have any future in long-distance space travel, plants are going to have to be part of that. And if you really want to get all sci-fi with me, I'm a lover of sci-fi. If we expect to colonize anything outside of Earth, we're going to need to be able to grow plants in vastly different environments than we do here on Earth. So this is a great conversation that just barely scratches the surface of this topic. I think Dr. Furl will be a multiple times future guest on this podcast just to talk about the myriad ways in which this research is being conducted. But why belabor the point? Let's head on over to my conversation with Dr. Furl. I hope you enjoy. Okay. Welcome, Dr. Robert Furl, to the Indefensive Plants podcast. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Hi, good morning. My name's Rob Furl. I'm a plant molecular biologist at the University of Florida, and my main scientific interest is how plants adapt to their environment, and that's basically how I got into looking at plants in space as a unique environment.
Awesome. And we have so much to talk about today. But first, I want to ask, was it always about plants for you, or do they just provide you with a convenient system in which to study genetic responses to environments?
Well, that's actually a very fair question. For me, plants were never the thing that I was in love with, if you can accept a sort of a non-botanical look at being a scientist.
That's fine.
Mostly what I've found plants to be is an extraordinarily good test bed, an extraordinarily good medium for which to dissect the way life interacts with its environment. And so I found plants to be a really useful tool and a really convenient laboratory rat for the things that I wanted to look at and to understand with regard to the way life, you know, moves around the planet finding places to live.
Interesting. And out of curiosity, I mean, there's a lot of different model organisms out there. When you say plants are really convenient ways of looking at these things, what do you mean by that? What makes plants different from a lot of other systems you could have potentially chosen?
Well, just sort of put yourself in a laboratory environment and think about, for some of us at least, what it was like 30 years ago when we didn't understand, for example, how genes were regulated or how they came up or went down or got more active or less active in response to an environmental stimulus. And we needed to have a way to sort of turn genes on and off in order to begin to dissect what those mechanisms were. And then later, how those genes going up and down allowed something to survive in a different environment. Plants, in my particular case, we could grow a bunch of corn from seeds. We could grow a bunch of Arabidopsis from seeds. They were all the same age, the same size, the same structure. And we could treat them all in the same way in the lab in a very convenient fashion. So one of the first stresses that biology overall tried to understand and use as a mechanism for turning genes on and off was quite simply to take a tray full of plants and flood them with water. All of a sudden, plants are underwater. Now, this is a native stress that occurs all the time in plants, so we expected there to be a mechanism there that we could understand. But the cool thing is that in the laboratory, we could take a whole population of plants, some of them mutant, for example, some of them not, put them all underwater at exactly the same time and have exquisite control over their environment. This was my entry into how do plants work, how do plant genes work, and how do plant genes work to help plants adapt to new environments. In that particular case, it was dissecting flooding as a response. Too much water, not enough oxygen. What does that do to a plant root? What does that do to a corn root, an Arabidopsis root? And how does what it does to that root instruct the plant's genetic systems to adapt?
That's cool. So they offer a very convenient methodology, like you said, to test how these genes are turning off in response to a stimulus. And I'm guessing a lot of that stems from the fact that you can, again, as you hinted at, control them a lot better than you can an animal in a condition like that. But when you say turning genes on and off, it's not something that you can visualize or see in person, right? How does one understand or wrap their head around figuring out whether or not a gene has been activated or not? What do you have to do after you flood them with water to check that response?
The biochemical student scientific approach is basically you pull them out, you grind them up, and you extract their RNA and use one of a number of mechanisms that are available these days to basically look at the expression profile of the entire genome. These days, we use RNA-seq, which is a high-throughput next-generation sequence analysis methodology that lets us look across the entire genome at every gene in the cells of the plants and ask which genes are going up and which are coming down.
So it's a matter of looking at it later on. This isn't something you can do in the lab and say, oh, look, I can tell by this plant's appearance that those genes are being activated. I guess you can in a sense if the, you know, it's a plastic response that happens over a few days, but this is something that needs to happen with, like you said, very advanced technology to understand.
Well, yes and no. For the discovery phase of what we're talking about here, and when we get into, for example, space flight discussion here in a few minutes, the ability to look genome-wide and use these high-throughput technologies gives us the biggest, baddest, most broadest picture of what's going on. But once we get a handle on some of that, there are methods that we can absolutely apply that allow us to watch in real time when genes are expressed and not expressed. We can't look at the whole genome at one time, but we can equip individual genes with reporter constructs so that they can express, for example, green or red fluorescent protein. And we can use special cameras just to watch when and where in a root, for example, those genes are expressed once we know what to look for.
Wow, that's got to be really exciting from a genetic standpoint, is just to see the physical manifestation of this without, again, having to run it through the sequencing machine. That's pretty remarkable.
It is, and it's actually one of the ways in which, for example, sort of traditional microscopy, the ability to look at cells individually together with the modern molecular tools allow this overlap between a cell biologist and a molecular biologist to really let us look at individual genes and individual cells go up and come down in response to stresses so that we can understand, for example, pulling again on flooding response, if you put a plant underwater, does the whole root respond in the same way? Do certain cells sense that they're underwater and send signals elsewhere? This really, really requires us not only to get the broad genome-wide perspective, but also to be able to look at individual cells and watch the various cell types move in concert or in response to one another to condition the whole plant to be able to survive.
Awesome. So you mentioned a couple of plants that you work with. Corn, for instance. Most people listening, I hope, know what corn is. But you mentioned another one, Arabidopsis, and people might be familiar with that in name. But what is this little plant, and why do so many scientists use it?
Well, one of the absolutely cool things about Arabidopsis is that it's very small. The seeds are small. The plants themselves are small compared to a corn plant. The other thing that's small is its genome. So it was the first plant to have its genome completely sequenced. So it became, for a lot of both genetic and molecular reasons, one of the very first, most well-adopted plant model species that basically let us have a small stature, a short generation time, a small genome, and a well-established sort of community of mutants to be able to choose from that let us do an awful lot of different kinds of molecular, cellular, and genetic biology in a really small package. So it's a member of the mustard family. It, instead of corn taking a couple of months to produce seeds, you can produce a generation in 6 weeks, wow, sometimes less. You can get a million seeds in a package that is small enough to fit into the palm of both hands. You can really do an awful lot when you have a small package like that to work with.
Cool. Yeah, I absolutely think they're adorable plants in and of the fact that, like, everything we've learned about them just makes them all that cooler. So, okay, now let's get into the meat of it. You started this discussion by saying one of the entries you had into this was understanding how roots respond to flooding, or plants in general respond to flooding. How do you go from understanding plants' response to flooding to how are plants going to respond to growing in outer space? What was that leap like for you?
Actually, the leap was not as dramatic as you might think. There's a scientific reason for that leap, but just sort of on a sociological perspective, I'm at the University of Florida. We're 3 hours by car from Kennedy Space Center. The biggest bulk of the sort of state's local interest in science focuses on Kennedy Space Center anytime there's a rocket going up or something like that. And in the 80s and especially the 90s, the space shuttle program was really literally taking off. So from our laboratory here, from any open field here in Gainesville, we could see the space shuttle headed up into space. When they started building the space station, we could see them, especially because the inclination of the orbits of the space station say that the space shuttle then had to not just head east, but had to head northeast as it left the Cape. So it would travel up the coast, and we could watch it for a long period of time. So just general interest had me looking at the space program. Now, there's a whole history of plants in space that would be really wonderful to talk about at some point. And so it's not a stretch that plants were among the earliest biological organisms to be studied on the space shuttle once it became active as a science platform. Now, growing plants in space, especially on the space shuttle and especially during the early days, was a difficult task. The growth chambers that you would put seeds into and the way you would manage water in the space shuttle was, you know, it's a challenging thing. You got this locker about the size of, your gym locker at work or school. And inside that locker, you have to put the entire life support system. The only thing you can supply it is electricity and some air and all of the stuff that it takes to grow a plant, the lights, the air conditioning, any monitoring of CO2 and oxygen and nutrients has to be taken care of inside that little box. And so the actual growth volume for growing plants on any experiment on the space shuttle, especially in those early days, was actually quite small, quite heavily managed. Those plants that came out of those early space shuttle experiments suffered. They didn't look so good. And one of the things that they looked like, now tugging on the science connection, is it looked like they'd been underwater. They oh. had a lot of signs of water stress, of having been flooded. And in fact, some of the proteins that had been detected as being elevated in space at that time were some of the same genes that we were studying having been elevated in response to being underwater.
Wow.
So basically, the ability of NASA, of space shuttle people, to be gardeners in space was limited by the fact that the plants inside these growth boxes that I told you about suffered, and they weren't looking as well as they wanted them to look like, and they acted a lot like plants that had been underwater. That's a long way around answering the question, but the scientific connection is actually very sound in that the response to the environment of spaceflight, especially in those early space shuttle flights, was not unlike the responses we were studying in the lab by putting plants underwater.
Wow, that's fascinating, and it's I want to get into that, but when you think about a plant, I can hardly think of an organism on this earth that's more terrestrial in nature than that, or at least for most cases. You know, roots have to grow down into the soil, shoots have to grow up. And if we're going to have any future in space as a human species, we're going to need to grow plants. So what are some of the challenges? I mean, you hinted at one, that plants weren't doing so well, but what does a terrestrial organism like a plant face in going into space? I mean, what were some of the challenges in growing them, other than the space limitation that you mentioned?
Yeah, so I'm going to have to pull on a couple of different threads and try to weave them together here a little bit. The first, from a pure scientist perspective, from my perspective, the notion that there is an environment that we can study that has never been experienced by an organism really lets us probe the edges of your question. In other words, are there truly, I mean, honest to goodness, are there limits to the ability of a plant, of an organism, of a human being to adapt? I mean, our genomes are built upon the experience that evolution has put into them. And our ability to respond to environments is derived from the programs that have been embedded in our DNA through those evolutionary experiences. Everything we know about our survival, and I'm talking about ours even if I'm a plant, everything about my survival is taught to me, is taught to my genome by my evolutionary experience. So now all of a sudden, you're going to take a seed, you're going to put it in orbit, a place where no plant has ever been, and you're going to ask it to be normal? Are you kidding me? So just like you're saying, the challenges of being an organism in a place where you have no adaptive preconditioning, to me, is just a fascinating question. Just a
certainly
absolutely fascinating question. Now, if I were an engineer going to try to grow something in space, or try to grow a human being or a plant or something to the point where it would live and do well in space, I would very much like to have the kind of spaceship that the people on the movie The Martian had, where they have this big rotating vessel that creates gravity. And so basically, if you can create a miniature Earth wherever you're going, then your adaptive processes are not all that difficult, because you've eliminated all the component stresses that might be affecting you. So if you are the kind of organism that lives in one gravity, that lives in a conditioned environment of CO2 and oxygen, and you're getting all your nutrients, then that's no big deal. So part of the whole space flight vision is to create a mini Earth wherever we go. unfortunately, engineering right now, in effect, the space program has no intention of building a space station or a transit vehicle that rotates enough to produce a gravity's worth of gravity in space. So for the foreseeable future, when we grow something in space, it's going to be like at the space shuttle in those days or the space station now. It'll be in a place where there is no gravity and no signals about whether a root should grow up or down, whether a shoot should grow up or down, or whether an individual cell knows what orientation it is within a developmental process. Things that we think are normally guided by and historically evolutionarily guided by gravity. What happens when you send it up there? I remain flabbergasted that you can take a seed, put it into orbit, ask it to germinate and turn into this large multicellular plant with many organ structures and stuff like that. And it will actually do that successfully in the absence of gravity.
Really?
I still remain astounded that leaves form, that roots form, that roots and leaves grow in different directions. Now we're learning a lot about the signals that condition that, but to me, that's just astounding that we as organisms can grow from a tiny seed into a complete plant in the absence of gravity.
Like, from a scientific standpoint, I can't think of a better control on the signals that organisms like plants are using to construct these bodies than to throw them, like you said, into the situation where there are none of the normal stimuli that they're used to. But in that sense, you know, you can look at a plant that's been exposed to a lifetime of wind or cold and look at one that hasn't and say, okay, I can see some developmental differences there. Could you pull a plant that has been grown on the space station next to a plant that has been grown here on Earth and see differences? Is it a matter of physically adapting to these unique conditions, or are they indistinguishable?
Yeah, so that really tugs at the very nature of the state of the art and the science that we and others in plant-based biology are working out on right now. By and large, at the sort of visible level, if you take a plant grown in the same engineering structure on Earth and one on orbit, you'd be fairly hard-pressed at the visual level to tell which one was which. Now, what that tells us is a number of things, and that is if you can, for example, use highly directional light in your growth chamber on orbit, you can very simply signal the plant that this is where the leaves got to grow towards, and the roots in a concomitant way understand that they need to grow away from the light. So it turns out that light takes over for gravity as one of the main directional cues in that situation. The people that are experts in gravitational biology and light signaling in plants have indeed used the space environment to understand more about the signals that guide that growth here on Earth. For example, John Kiss found out that there are a lot of subtle light signals that on Earth are overridden in the laboratory by the overwhelming force of gravity. You move that away and you can start studying the other things that have a subtle but very important impact on the signaling of the way that plant roots choose their direction of growth, for example.
Wow. I love this idea of having to leave Earth to understand that. It's just kind of, it's a very romantic form of science. And will these plants then go through a normal life cycle, provided these light signals continue on in a way that they're adapted, or at least they're genetically predisposed to comprehend them, like such as daylight hour versus night hours? Is it similar, or is it just a matter of controlling the lights to replicate what they would have experienced here on Earth?
Yeah, so there's a lot of nuances to your question, and I'm going to sort of oversimplify my answer and say, yes.
That's fair enough.
So, all right. So the slightly longer answer is that once we as scientists learn to be good gardeners on orbit, we've pretty much managed to grow the plants that we have chosen, and I'm using this we very broadly, the community has learned to grow plants basically from seed to seed pretty well. There are a lot of really interesting stories on how we got there. And the first is for some plants, for example, wheat, to make a chamber big enough to grow dwarf wheat even on the space station or space station mirrors where it was most successfully grown is actually a pretty big engineering challenge. Space station mirror, the Russian space station, is one of the places where a lot of plant growth studies of this type were done to ask the question, can you grow through a complete life cycle of a plant? Can we expect plants to go through and make seeds and have those seeds be useful to us or to them in space? Was a big question in the 80s and especially the 90s. And it was on the space station mirror that the first wheat, for example, was grown from seed to seed. It turns out one of the more interesting difficulties of growing plants to seed in space, and especially in a closed environment where the atmosphere is so tightly regulated and sort of unexchanging, is the potential buildup of ethylene, of course, which will discourage seeds from forming. And it was a tough on space station mirror to get wheat to grow to produce seeds, in part because of buildup of ethylene and in part because of the arrival of fresh fruits and melons to the Mir space station, and they brought ethylene with them. Another source of ethylene-like compounds are the plastics and the other silicons that are used in spaceflight building. So once we learned to be good gardeners, once we understood that incoming cargo vessels might bring ethylene, that our plastics and our silicones might off-gas ethylene-like products, once we learned to control all that stuff, we got better and better at producing plants that would go through their complete life cycle. So right now, the long answer after the simple answer of yes, the long answer is that once we learn the engineering skills to be good gardeners in orbit, we can pretty much ask plants to do all of the normal plant things.
Wow.
Maybe even other things.
That is remarkable and exciting to think that what was originally thought of as a challenge imposed upon these organisms just by being in space was actually the step of things that we were doing and the chemicals that we were using and the foods we were bringing with us. That is just, I love those kinds of scientific discoveries because it's that until you think about it in a slightly different way, then you can unlock the doors to
exactly
doing a bunch of new things. So you yourself do not go into space, and it's always amazing to me the amount of rigor that goes into launching any sort of spacecraft, the amount of weight and the amount of size of things that you can bring up. So as a scientist that needs to have a certain type of experiment set up and strict standards to design, I mean, I realize astronauts are all very intelligent, capable human beings, but how do you, the amount of foresight you need to send a package into space is amazing, but then how do you conduct these studies or at least have someone execute these studies in space where you're just going, well, it's gone now and I hope that works.
So basically, you're asking about the operational context of a particular kind of experiment, and I'm gonna wax philosophical here for just a little bit.
Go for it.
The era of the space shuttle, when science was actually going to be conducted in the vehicle, was a wonderful place for a number of kinds of these questions to be worked out. A good number of the space shuttle missions were dedicated to science. In other words, there were scientists on board. They had room in the laboratories that could be put into the payload bay to do experiments. And the community learned about the boundaries for how much mass could be considered a reasonable experiment to launch, how much time it might take somebody in space to do a simple thing here on Earth, for example, peel a plant off from a petri dish and freeze it, or peel a plant off from a petri dish and cut it up into small pieces and freeze it, or put it into preservative, Could we take microscopes along? The space shuttle was the proving ground for a community of scientists to interact with a community of operations and logistics experts to start putting boundaries around these things. So we as a community learned about the number of plants. And if you can imagine, again, Arabidopsis being one that is small and you could put a large number of them up in a small volume, those things all sort of came together and helped us put an envelope around the size of an experiment we could expect to fly. When we got to the space station era, the plant growth units on orbit got bigger, they got more robust, we could do more things. There's a microscope on orbit where we can do fluorescence microscopy on live plants in real time from there to down here.
Wow.
So we've begun to expand that envelope and now understand with somebody that is resident in space for a long period of time, how much effort can we expect from them? What can they do in terms of laboratory actions like pipetting and handling seeds? How do you do that in zero gravity? And as a big part of that, the processes of basically developing procedures for operations in space, working with astronauts to understand what it takes to teach them and inform them how to be good scientists and students for your laboratory while they are in space, and then how to develop the communication skills and pathways to make that happen in real time has really all come together in a very nice way. I have to say that the astronauts that we've interacted with have all been smart, have all been capable. They've also all been very interested, and they don't treat our science as anything other than the reason that they are there. It's not something that they have to do on the side of what they do. No, it's what they want to do. And just to take a brief aside, anybody that's gotten to work with plants while they're stuck in a steel can on orbit, away from the Earth, breathing only conditioned air, when they get to interact with plants, when they get to see a living thing, when they get to smell something that reminds them of Earth, they're happy to be working on plants.
Sure.
So plants have historically been both good experimental test beds, but also something that keeps astronauts engaged as much as any other science in space.
I love it. It's a beautiful story because it's a story of collaboration, people working together for a common cause, and just reiterates the fact that there's something inherent in the human psyche that when you see plants or when you're interacting with life, you know, space gets lonely, and that is important. I know how I feel after, you know, a few hours in the lab having to go down and I just walk through the greenhouse and I feel instantly better. I'm sure that's just magnified, like you said, when you're in the steel can, so removed from anything that you're familiar with as a species. That's remarkable.
Yep, and I have to amplify that just a little bit, because while the psychosocial value of being around plants has anecdotally been recognized even in the space program for a long time, it's only recently that the medical sort of sciences has begun to put real hard data on the value of humans and their interactions with plants. I have a friend here that works with the cancer center and the greenhouse that is dedicated to being there for cancer center patients to visit. And they do things like brain scans, PET scans, and other data on people that interact with plants versus people that don't interact with plants. And those kind of hard data are informing the space program about the intrinsic value of having plants as part of the life support loops that we will take with us, especially on very long voyages. So the notion that we all have, that walking in the greenhouse and smelling the plants after coming in from some place where there is no plants or there is a lot of stress, is now something that is a quantifiable, brain scannable, understandable phenomenon. And the more that we can draw from the medical community that is studying these kinds of interactions, the more we'll appreciate that in the long-term life support of humans in space.
That is fantastic. And I think that is a message that will resonate with everyone listening to this right now. But this is something that's going to be ongoing, you know, with talk about going to Mars and just any sort of long-term planned space mission. Like you said, the plants are going to have to be a major component of this. So looking forward as a scientist, what excites you? What are you trying to conquer next? What's on the horizon for you?
Well, I would say that we are sort of passing through the phase of using the space station to understand these basic phenomenon of adaptation. We now have a pretty good idea of why plants in space and in space vehicles can be different than those here on Earth. We understand the relationship, for example, between air pressure. And it turns out that some of the vehicles that we've traveled in as human beings in space have had less than one full atmosphere of pressure. Wow. That's really interesting. Normally, when we deal with pressure here on Earth, we have to go up a mountain. Well, as anybody knows, there's a place where you can go up the mountain, and yes, the air pressure is low, but it's also cold. So the ability to think about pressure separate from temperature and the ability to probe that as a scientist has been presented to us from our work with the space program. The space station has allowed us, a lot of us, to truly begin to understand and maybe even build good models for the way that gravity has its effects on plants and the way that plants in the absence of gravity alter their biochemistry, and it turns out mostly it seems their cell wall structure, to adapt, to be better sort of space plants than they would be here on Earth. I think we're passing through that particular phase, and that sort of aligns very much with the life of the space station. Over the coming decades, we will see, and in fact, you may have seen in the news that the United States is looking to get its space exploration legs working towards deeper space missions. So we're back now to thinking about going to the moon and going to Mars in a fairly serious way. NASA's turning its eyes from low Earth orbit into what's called deep space. Our ability then to support deep space missions as plant biologists is really what the future is going to be. We've used the current time to understand how plants adapt to space and how we might build better plants for space flight, how we might better understand the interactions between plants and the people that are in space flight. The next 10 years, the next 20 years will be about deploying plants in useful ways to study, to help people sort of live on their way to Mars on a 3-year mission. Remember that we just had Scott Kelly spend a year on the space station. We know a little bit about living long-term close to the Earth. We know little about living long-term away from the Earth. So these concepts of being sealed up in a can for 3 years on the way to Mars and back, and people's interactions with plants under that is really, really where we're headed. NASA is talking about building in sort of a mini space station, a gateway station that will be in orbit around the moon or in that cislunar space. As scientists, we're turning our eyes to what kind of experiments we can put into a smaller space station, one that's outside the protection of the Van Allen belt. So radiation and radiation effects on plants will be one of the key kinds of features that we'll be studying as scientists while we are helping the engineers keep people alive for longer periods of time.
Wow. Very exciting new frontiers and new chapters to be opened up by the sounds of it. So you've got a fulfilling set of questions to continue to be asking and testing, and it sounds like space offers one of the most ultimate laboratories in which to do this.
I don't know about one of the most ultimate, but if you are at all interested in exploration and extreme environments, getting back to sort of what brought me into the business in the first place, spaceflight is definitely one of those areas where, as a scientist, you can really probe the edges of the envelope. If you are at all interested in exploration, then the notion that what you do can help the species explore deeply into the solar system, that adds just a component of coolness that does make that laboratory sort of at least one of the most extreme ways in which we can study biology, terrestrial biology.
Excellent. Well, this has been enlightening. Dr. Frill, I really thank you for taking time. I think I speak for everyone. I say keep us included in what's going on. We look forward to updates. This is very exciting work.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the ability to get the word out on space biology. It's boy, if we had a few more hours, I'd love to tell you about the very special roles that, for example, plants had during the 1960s and our exploration of the moon. They played a huge role back then. They have an unsung role in the early space shuttle program with regard to how experiments and biology moves off the surface of the Earth. And so I'd love to keep you informed, and I'd love for people to just poke around a little bit more, Google space program and plants, and take a look at some of the things that are being done. It's an incredibly fun place to study plant biology.
Awesome. Well, I will definitely have you back on the podcast. I think we just came up with another idea for a new episode, so we'll have to re-coordinate that. But again, thank you for taking time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Have a great one.
Cheers.
Alrighty. That was great. I'm going to have Dr. Frill back on to just at least give us a nice history lesson on the research of plants in space. But wow, how excellent is his research? Of course, he doesn't work alone. He has many colleagues to thank and collaborators that he's worked with over the years. I've put up links to his website up on the page for this episode, so go check it out. Science doesn't happen in a vacuum, and you get to see everyone else that's been involved in this project. But again, I thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your support. It really does mean the world to me. I still have stickers for sale, so head on over to indefensiveplants.com/shop and pick some up. They're waterproof. You can put them anywhere. And 50% of every purchase is donated to the North American Orchid Conservation Center, serving to protect and understand orchid diversity here in North America. All right, everyone. This is it for this week. Stay tuned. Amazing updates for my trip to Costa Rica, all set for the next few weeks of release. So best way to do that is to hit that subscribe button. And while you're there, give the podcast a review. All right, everyone, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.